Where were you to start with?
Well, I was over Halberstadt, Germany. We were bombing a Focke-Wulf plant there. Oh, I had lost in that number two engine, go an hour and 47 minutes in over France. Number two engine just conked out on me. Now I'm in trouble because I've only got three engines, and I can't turn to the left very well. Because if you got down to the left, the two good engines would pull you into a spin. So I had to keep the left wing up. And they made a left-hand turn off the target, which put me out of the formation. The big idea was to stay in the formation at all costs. Otherwise, you were like the Indians in the covered wagons. Once they got you out there alone, you were buzzard meat.
The German fighter pilots would come after you?
Oh, sure, yeah. They could see you 20 miles away with one engine feathered. That engine is stopped out there. And the next thing I knew, I was flying formation with nine ME-109 Messerschmitts. But they were out of gun range. And I thought, first off, I knew they were developing diesel engines. And I saw this guy out at 9 o'clock belch smoke out of him. And I said, geez, somebody's hit him, you know, with our guns. But he pulled ahead, crossed over high, and came right down at 1 o'clock. And they had a 20-millimeter cannon in the nose. And when they shot, you could see the smoke ring come out of the nose of their aircraft. And I knew, but right then, out went the right windshield. Oh, man. Three and four engine caught on fire, and we were in big-time trouble. But unbeknownst to me, my gunners did shoot down three of them for sure. They blew up one off a tail and one out in front of us. And I'm not sure about the fourth one, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So
then your engines were on fire.
Oh, yeah.
And
with the B-17, the gas tanks were in the wing. And when your engines are on fire, it won't take long for them to eat through a firewall. And they gave you a 10-second comfort zone there to get out of it. So I got all my guys out. There was a little darky station that you pushed, and it dinged, and that meant for them to get out because it would blow up once the...
Uh-huh.
And they had a nasty habit of doing that. So I got my crew all out, and I had to jump down to the lower deck to go out myself, which I was ready to do. But I wanted to check to see if anybody was hit down there, and there was no one there. But I could look up at those two engines up there, and they didn't look that bad from underneath. So I said, well, now if I can go back up there and dive this thing from 22,000 feet down to about 15, an old fella told me maybe you can blow them out, see?
So the fire's out.
Yeah, blow the fires out. So I did that. I went back, knocked her off of autopilot, and dove her down to 15,000 feet approximately. And as I pulled her out, they went out, incidentally. I said, gee, I can glide this thing across the Rhine and then bail out, and I can walk into France and get into the underground. But the minute I leveled off, they flared right up again. So I decided I better get out. Now, we would put the plane in an unflyable attitude when we went out on autopilot. That meant it was flying sideways. So when it hit the ground, it would explode and mess itself up so the Germans wouldn't get it. So that's what I did. And then I went out, yes. So
uh-huh.
Now, we were told to delay our jumps to get out of the shooting up there. And I figure I fell from about 15,000 feet down to about, maybe 5,000. But I said, well, I better not cut it too much shorter. So I pulled my chute, and it worked perfect, yes. And I can't believe how quiet everything was. I could hear the birds chirping, and it was working perfect. Oh, and I went out over a heavily forested area. Now, everyone on the crew would have an escape kit, we called it. It had to come.
Did you land in a tree?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. And the tree bent. Oh, it was a pine tree, a big one. It bent down once, back up, twice, and backed up. Three times it came off the tree and let me down just as if I stepped down off the porch stoop. It worked perfect, yeah. So now the procedure is to lay all your gear, like your jacket and your helmet, We wore infantry helmets up there, if you can believe it, and in a line, and then run the other way. And the Germans would always go where you left the trail, which I did, and, oh, I ran. I was in some good shape in those days, boy. So I ran, and I ran. And all I heard was dogs barking in the distance. And then I found a big pile of brush that I crawled in. And the procedure is to travel at night and sleep or hide out during the day. So I stayed in that pile of brush until nighttime. And then we had maps and everything else. But I figure I walked a good 180 miles towards Holland because now I know I can't get into France. And I had two big cities I had to go around, Hanover and, I forget the other one. And that wasted so much of my time. I was gassing out fast now. I didn't have anything to eat for 8 days now.
And you tried to walk at night.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And stay low in the day. Okay, so how many days did you walk?
Eight days.
And
it was pouring rain this night, so I... And don't think going into a haystack will keep you warm because it was early spring and, man, it was all hoarfrost in there. I don't like the frozen. But this night it was pouring rain and I figured, well, I got to hitch a ride on a train because I'm not making it this way. So I walked into the nearest railroad yard with the idea of jumping on a train or riding the rails or something because I did that when I was a kid and see what happens. Well, I walked into this railroad yard, and it's a wonder I didn't get shot because there was an overpass, a footpath, with an armed guard up there, but he was hiding out of the rain, too. So I walked right in, and I laid down or sat down next to a switching shack with a big overhang, and I fell asleep. And the next morning, I was awakened by a big crowd kicking me. And say, wake up, and hollering in German. I don't know what he was saying. But now we were told, as a last resort, to act like an imbecile. So I did. I took my fingers and put them in my blah, 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 and I played high school football. And I hit him, boy. He was twice as big as me. And then he started hollering in German. And the Germans came out of the warehouses. They came. Well, my jig was up then, yes. So.
And so what happened then?
Oh, they called the police. I was taken to a local police jail, and they called the military, of course. And the military sent a nice young lieutenant, flyer, up from the nearest German airfield, and he could speak English better than I could. And he said, if you promise me or give me your word that you won't run, I won't shackle you. They were going to handcuff my feet and hands and legs and everything else. I said, no, no, no. I said, I'm so damn weak now, I can hardly walk, you know. So he did. He took me down to the German airfield. So I have my ring that my wife worked for during a training session and bought. And then I had a silver bracelet that had your name on it in case you got in a fire. That would be a thing. And my wristwatch, which was a Hamilton. It was good when my father bought it for me. And there they were on this colonel's desk at this airfield that the lieutenant took me to. And the colonel started hollering at this poor lieutenant flyer. And he said to me, he thinks, and we had $25,000 in perfect counterfeit bill to bribe any Germans that we could. But the police had taken all this, and somebody got the $25,000. So he said, can you make the colonel understand that I didn't take it? And I said, I will if you tell him I want my ring, my bracelet. And I said, that's not military, that's mine. And he took his finger and shot it across the desk to me. I put them all on. And I said, Pion, that's the little town they caught me in. And I said, the police and the lieutenant is interpreting all this. And I believe somebody got shot for that. He picked up that phone, and you want to hear in German. I don't know what it was. But, boy, somebody was in big-time trouble because he didn't get the money. So, yeah.
Uh-huh. So now you wound up in a prison camp.
Frankfurt on the Main for questioning. So then I was on my way from Frankfurt on the Main to Stalag Luft 3, and that's where the big escape was pulled off.
Now, you went in there soon after the big escape happened?
Oh, no, I had nothing to do with that.
No,
that
but I know. But
yeah, soon after, yeah.
Soon after,
those men had pulled. Yes, yeah. So.
And now tell us about what happens when you go into prison camp.
Oh, yes. The whole camp, and it must have been 200 American flyers and some British, would go down to the gate and try to recognize new prisoners coming through. Because if you weren't recognized or identified, they sent you to an isolation barracks because they didn't know whether you were a German plant put in there to spy on us. And they could, like I say, they could speak English better. They knew all the baseball scores and rules and everything else. But if you were identified, then you went into the regular PW prisoner of war camp. And there were two guys. One lived only three houses away from me. He was a major, Major Geary, and he's dead now, though. He recognized me. He played football with me. He was my aunt.
In high school?
In high school.
Okay.
And another fellow by the name of Ken Harneman, who was a track guy. He was a navigator. He recognized me right away. And in fact, Geary said, "Boy, what are you doing in here?" I said, "Man, same thing you're going to be doing." Yeah. So that was my induction into prison camp.
So now, just a little bit, to tell us a little bit about what it was like to be a prisoner of war.
Oh,
what was the food like?
Well, up until Thanksgiving, it wasn't too bad. We got an International Red Cross, each man in prison camp, a parcel, and it would keep one man alive in good condition for a week. There was hardtack, there was canned meat, Spam was the... Oh, we had to go on a barter system in prison camp. And Spam was the top 100-point thing, a can of Spam, which was in the parcels. And there were cheeses and everything else. At Thanksgiving, they cut us to a sixth. That was a parcel for every sixth guy. And at Christmas time, they cut us to a 12th. And you couldn't divide it up amongst 12 men. So we took all the food and put it, and incidentally, I was a pan maker, and one of my pans, which were made out of tin cans, and with water, and and when it hardened, we would cut it into 12 pieces and give it. I guess I told you I weighed 105 pounds when I got out of there.
Wow.
Yeah, so January 27th, they came in. Oh, there must have been 7-8 inches of snow on the ground, and so you'd be ready to march in an hour. The Russians were coming. Well, we knew this, but we were a week behind on the news. We were getting BBC News.
How did you get that news?
They bribed a guard to bring in radio parts. And we had radio operators in our camp. And they put our radio together. And we would get it, but like I say, it was a week old. The Germans wouldn't give it to us. So we knew they were close. And they marched us from Poznan, well, we call it Poland, it was right on the board, to Nuremberg.
Okay.
Where the war crime trials, I think, were held. Uh-huh. Yeah. And there, we went through three major air raids and maybe a dozen nuisance raids. The British would come in all night long with 2,000 pounders and drop them, never on schedule, just to keep them awake. But the 8th Air Force then came in 3 days with the major raids. And we were between Nuremberg, railroad tracks, and the prison camp. And the British bombed at night because their losses were so great. And that Pathfinder would come down, drop flares on the railroad tracks. And we thought they were going after the railroad tracks, which was close to our camp. But they were evidently marking a line not to drop them on the camp,
keeping
to the right, yeah.
Okay. And now you marched again after
that. Oh, yes. Well, now the Americans were coming from the other direction, and Nuremberg to Würzburg, and that was only about 40 miles. So they marched us then down towards Birch's Garden, the Eagle's Lair, where Hitler had his place up in the mountains. And I think he was going to try to hold us as hostages. But Patton's 13th and 14th Armored Division. Now, get this. There were about 200 of us, and this chokes me up. Sent 20,000 men to get me out of prison.
Patton sent 20,000 soldiers to save you guys.
You wouldn't believe how nice these guys were.
Now, how did you know that the Americans were getting close?
Oh, through our radio. But yeah, okay. After we got a report, we would take the radio operators would take the radio all apart in little pieces, and each guy would take a piece. And when they wanted, they would get together and put it together again.
But the day that you saw Patton, or the few days before, you were telling me that the guards had started to disappear?
Oh, yes. The night before the infantrymen came in, our guards were SS troopers came in and wanted our guards to retreat with them down to a bridge 20 miles away. And they were mostly older guys, and they didn't want any part of this because they knew the story. And they wanted to be captured by the Americans instead of the Russians. Now, I heard this. I didn't know. But the last SS guy out of their barracks turned a submachine gun on him, and I don't know how many shot.
Ooh,
yeah,
yikes.
They were considered traitors because they wouldn't continue to fight. But then the infantry came in, and they set up a field kitchen right away. And that evening, they said, now we're going to have an artillery barrage. Those Germans are holding a bridge down 20 miles down a river, and we're going to shoot them out. But they're going to shoot over our heads. And we were at the end of the cannons. And I can't believe, it's a wonder I'm not deaf. I had to put my fingers in my ears to knock the, yeah. And then they just kept coming and coming, our infantry. Oh, it was a Sunday morning, May 30th, and I got shot down on May 30th, a year later. There was a lot of shooting going on around the prison camp. So we did have some slit trenches, which we all got into. And there was a 90-foot chimney over in the city. And we stayed in those slit trenches from about early morning until noontime. And one of our guys had enough nerve to stick his head out. And he's, oh, man, look at this. And there was the American flag.
Oh, cool.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Let's see. What else?
But, you know, like I say, it was wonderful. And those GIs treated us like we were brothers.
Uh-huh. And you tell me that Patton gave a speech and he didn't swear once? He has a reputation?
Our senior commander, we got it clean. The British had a few old barracks. We were sleeping in Africa Corps tents on straw. And we got to clean the barracks up because he's going to want to inspect something. And so we did. We got up and cleaned the barracks all up. And we steered him into that. And he came back, and I wasn't standing from me, you to me. Yeah. And he said, I want to commend you men on a fine military bearing you maintain under these conditions. And I'll do everything in my power to see that you're flown out tomorrow. So we all marched down to the nearest little German airfield, which was a fighter field. And we ransacked everything. I got Luger pistols out of the police station. The planes that were going to come for us were the paratrooper planes, C-47s. That's what we call them. They got lost. So we had to sleep on the airfield for a night, right out, it was all right. And they came in. But now, before they let us on the airplanes, do you know what a flit gun is?
No.
Well, it was a can on a pump, and it disinfectant. And you had to take your hat off, and they flit this powder down inside your clothes to make sure you didn't have any bugs on you, taking the airplanes. So that was funny as hell because we all got flitted. We said, yeah.
And where did they? And where did you go then?
Well, they took us to Le Havre, France, where the big infantry division left, and gave us showers. First shower in 8 months. I still tease people about it. So I only take one now every 3 months, whether I need it or not.